Hi, my name's Mildred. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I have to laugh at the record button because when I was drinking, you know, they used to roll their eyes when they'd see me coming. Nobody was recording what Mildred had to say. So, this is funny. So to all newcomers that are here, you know, they record us. You know, we have something maybe useful to say. So I'm very grateful to be here. I'd just like to say thank you to Thaddeus for the great service and the excellent convention. It's been a fantastic weekend and a privilege to be here, and to Paul and to the whole team. So in Sweden, I live in Sweden, I'm Irish. I go to AA meetings in Swedish, and because I don't want to live in an expat bubble in Sweden, I've recently moved there. I've been spending the last 30 years as an expat in a foreign country. But I intend to live the rest of my life in Sweden, so I'm going to local meetings, and we say thanks a lot. Thanks for service. Every time we share, we open up with some gratitude. So I'd just like to say thank you again. It's been a wonderful convention so far, and I hope that the finale is okay, and that I can share my experience, strength, and hope. I was a nutcase. I was an absolute fruitcake. So as I said, I come from Ireland, drinking, it's just part of the culture. And we all drank. I come from an alcoholic family, just normal. I didn't suffer because of that. And my brother perhaps did suffer, but I'm such a self-centered person in my own little world. I didn't even realize that Daddy was dying from alcoholism, because that was Mildred in her own little world. And so he was very fortunate. He had 6 months to live, but AA came and saved him, and he eventually did die, but a sober man with long-term sobriety. But there was I as a child, very self-conscious, very self-centered, wasn't really interested in what was going on in that family, and didn't really feel like I belonged in that family. So I was in another world totally. I often think that I was a person that was very, very distant, very cold, and it was self-centeredness, pure self-centeredness. I had a nervous disposition, talks about that in the big book. I think today I still have a nervous disposition, but that nervousness escalated when I started to drink, and eventually it turned into anxiety and paranoia. But my basic personality was, you know, self-centered, could talk, I could speak to people, and people thought I was nice, but I wasn't really interested in people very much. And I really got excited when I started to drink. That's when life really started to happen for this alcoholic. And started in my, when I was about 17, went to university, liked Guinness, liked whiskey, so could throw back an awful lot of pints. And I always felt that my self-esteem really grew when I drank, because I could drink. I could hold my drink. I was very proud of the fact that I could drink pints of Guinness and whiskey in between. And I would often tell the band, get off stage, Mildred wants to sing tonight. And so I was a bit of a... People thought I was fun, but the morning after I felt humiliation. But others thought I was great crack, as we say back in Ireland. And strange things happened to me when I drank from the beginning. So blackouts were normal. Blackouts were normal for this alcoholic from the beginning right to the end. But I didn't mind blackouts, because I didn't want to remember. Because as prior to drinking, I was quite self-righteous, highly opinionated. I knew what was right, what was wrong for you. And when I drank, it's like I didn't seem to care about these great opinions that I had, and I broke all the rules that I had myself. And I became very dishonest, very deceitful. So when, if I didn't remember that I actually slept with somebody's husband, I was glad not to remember. Because when I drank, I lost control of my behavior. I didn't know how many drinks it was going to be. I didn't know where I would end up, if I would wake up in the same town or in another town. These crazy things happened to me. I just disappeared. So when I was about 20, I'm a little embarrassed, because some of the things, crazy things that happened to me when I was drinking was not when I was 14, 15, 16, where you could excuse me because I was a teenager. And many of the crazy things that happened to me was when I was in my 20s. You know, I was supposed to be a young adult. I was educated, went to university, but kept drinking. And but I'm just trying to say that from the beginning and right into my 20s, I mean, I shouldn't have been drinking. I was the type of person that couldn't drink because of this unpredictability that would happen and because of the shame and the humiliation that I would feel the day after. And then I would just want to drink to get over that. I would just want to drink again. But there were some crazy things, signals that I should have listened to, but I couldn't afford to listen to. It was too scary to even contemplate that maybe I shouldn't be drinking, because I felt I was really living when I was drinking. I was free from worry, anxiety, self-consciousness when I was drinking. But when I was about 20, I think I was 20 years old, my university professor, he said to me, "You need to get your ass to France, because if you don't, I'm going to fail you in your finals," because my spoken French wasn't so good and I was studying French. And so I went off to France as a 20-year-old and got a job in an old folks' home. I forget what they called it, in Draguignan, en Provence. And I thought, you know, this is great. I'm living the life. I'm in an old folks' home, and which was a sort of little hotel. I think we took the old folks out from Aix-en-Provence and brought them to Draguignan. And this was just great. And lots of wine and lots of beer. And they said to me, "Okay, Mildred, you take care of this one lady." And this one, any law enforcement officers in the room today? French from Draguignan. So I was to take care of this one lady who was a cripple, and she couldn't walk, wheelchair bound. And so I thought, okay, that's my job. I take care of her, and then the rest of the time I'm going to enjoy your French wine and your French beer. And I discovered that this lady liked to drink, and I heard the others calling her an alcoholic. So I thought, well, this is great. So we drank together in her bedroom, the two of us. And every day we drank. I was there for 1 month, and we drank. And I realized that if I just filled her up with a lot of drink, then I didn't have to do much with her in the afternoon. If I got her polluted in the morning, and then I just put her to bed then, around lunchtime, she didn't need much feeding. And then I had the rest of the day then. They thought I was taking care of her, but I could just continue drinking on my own and have a great time. And I was totally, totally crazy. And I got that poor old woman so drunk that she was there in the bed, really, really drunk, and she started to shake. And I thought, oh, Jesus Christ, she's going to feckin' die on me. And I can go back and I can remember this 20-year-old. It was like I was in a movie or something. I wasn't in reality. It's like I was in a movie, and I started to take, I carried this body into the bathroom, and I gave her a shower, because if she was going to die, she was going to look good. And I was going to hide the evidence. And this Irish woman, you know, got her, killed her drunk. And I put her through that, the poor woman, and all she could say in English was, "God damn you, fecking child." She had no other English, and that's all she kept saying to me. And I got her back to the bedroom, put her nightie on, I covered her in talcum powder, because the smell of drink was awful, the place was reeking. And the woman, when I got her back to the bed, she lay down, head on the pillow, she passed out and she died on me. I literally fed this woman so much drink that she died. It was incredible. And then I saw the bottles everywhere, the place was stinking, and I thought, okay, Mildred, now you're going to tidy up, you open up the windows, and then you scream and you act like a very distraught Irish girl. It was like a film, like I was in a film. I wasn't in reality at all. I was absolutely crazy. And I did that. Then I tidied up, I screamed, and the head doctor came in to her bedroom, and he looked at me, and the state of me, I was legless. And he just said, "Mildred, I need to call the gendarmes. You are not to be here when they arrive. You are to go upstairs and stay upstairs." And I went upstairs, and then I woke up perhaps, I don't know, an hour or so later, thirsty. And I come walking down the stairs, and the gendarme are there, and they're wheeling the body out, and all I want is a drink. And I go in, I help myself to a drink, and I walk back up the stairs. And there was lots more drama, but that was basically the story. Crazy. And And the crazy thing about that is I never took that seriously. That for me was just a great story to tell people, you know, when I'm drinking. I never thought about that was somebody's grandmother. You know, that was a real person. Absolutely crazy 20-year-old, and I continued drinking. And of course, I didn't tell my mother that story, but I continued drinking, and I got lots of drink at the bar when I told that story. You know, you want to hear a good one? Buy me a drink. I'll tell you a great story. So I shouldn't have been drinking. You know, I shouldn't have been drinking. I went crazy when I drank. And I went back. I went back to Ireland, graduated. I bummed around, did bits of jobs here and there. Didn't know what I wanted to do. I was kind of lost. I was a lost soul, always looking for other people to fix the job for me, fix the interview for me. And then I ran away to Spain. Somebody fixed a job for me in Spain. And why not? Why not? My mid-20s, off I go to Spain. And things had been, I'd been getting drunk a lot, in a lot of debt in Ireland at that time. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go to Spain. It's going to be different, you know, geographical. I'll be different. The very first night in Spain, I get polluted. I'm in bed with my new boss, and he's married. And this is Spain, my new life in Spain. Here we go, all over again. And crazy drinking in Spain, drinking in the morning, drinking in the afternoon, drinking at nighttime, coming into work drunk. English teacher in Spain. And one morning I go in, and there was one student that day, and he said, "Teacher, I think I'll teach today. You sit down." And he gave me class because I was so polluted. And the next day he came in with an advertisement for a job in another part of town. And he said, "Teacher, I think these people are not a good influence on you. You need to go to another school." So, but this was me. I was lost, mid-20s. So drinking every day, sleeping around, not knowing who I was with. And I managed to get myself pregnant. And I'm this little Irish Catholic girl, extremely religious. And she gets herself pregnant, and she's broke, and she's in a foreign country. And so what does she do? Any normal human being, they call a doctor. Mildred drinks, and drinks, and drinks. Every single day, doesn't tell anybody she's pregnant. She thinks that if she just keeps drinking, the problem will go away. And until I'm about 9 months pregnant, and somebody notices, and then I deny it. No, I'm not. And so then that... I had the students, they helped, they were doctors. I had doctors, I had bankers. They helped me with that problem. So we gave that baby up for adoption in Spain. And they sorted everything out for me, because that's what people are there for, to fix things for me. I don't need to take responsibility. I'm too busy feeling so much responsibility. And then I continue to drink and drink because I'm sad. Poor me, look what's happened to me. I had to give up my child. And you drink if you have my problems too, feeling so sorry for myself. And then I back to Ireland, another geographical, because in Ireland I'm drinking on the job, I'm coming in drunk, I'm missing days off work. So it's kind of a pathetic kind of a story. It's just a lot of drinking and a lot of blackouts and a lot of coming to work late. And I don't think I stayed in a job more than a year. I was always moving on. Relationships changing. Boyfriends, if I had any, there was usually one-night stands. And changing countries, just on the run, that's what it felt like. I was just running for me. But everywhere I went, lo and behold, I arrived with myself. You know, I thought I could escape, but no, I arrived with myself. Until I arrived in Belgium. So, okay, this time I'm going to Belgium. Just met a girl at a party who lived in Belgium. Why not go to Belgium? Because I was coming in drunk to work, missing days at the job. And I said, "I'll go to Belgium and I'll be a secretary." And I've been everything. So this time I'll be a secretary and I'll get myself a pair of glasses, because I was up to then wearing one contact lens. I lost it in a glass of whiskey or something. I put my lenses into a glass of whiskey one night and somebody threw my lenses down the drain pipe. So I managed to recover one. And so I said, okay, I'm going to be responsible, I'm going to get myself a pair of glasses, I'm going to work as a secretary, and I'm going to act like a secretary. And I thought secretaries were very decent human beings, respectable. And didn't last very long. Coming into work, I was a trilingual secretary, I convinced them that I was fluent in a lawyer's office. I told them I was fluent in Spanish, but all I knew was una cerveza, por favor. And I had to take dictation in Spanish. That was bad. You know, if you had a job like that, you'd have to drink. And I got away with it for a couple of months, maybe 4 or 5 months. And then it was just bad. It was just bad. It was bad all the time. It was bad in Barcelona. It was bad in Ireland. It was pathetic. I was in despair. I cried so much all the time. I walked around the streets. I would go into parks crying, hoping that somebody, like a decent family, would look at me and say, oh, she needs help, and that they would just take me home and help me. I was pathetic, lost kind of a soul, looking for somebody else to fix things for me. And I prayed and I prayed and I went to Mass and went to church and all of that, but I still suffered. My suffering was still there. It wasn't working. And the thought about maybe you shouldn't drink, Mildred. But there was a period of abstinence on my trips back and forth to Ireland. And during that period of abstinence, I had a nervous breakdown, a total nervous breakdown. So I knew I had to drink. If I didn't drink, I would crack up. The drink kept the nerves together. So there was no choice for me. I had to drink. Until the moment, and I don't know why, it was just another bad night. Just another bad night. Going into a pub, going down to the cellar, hiding my drinking because people were looking out for me. And I see a creep walking down the stairs. And I said to myself, what a creep. And I continued drinking. Something happened during the night, as it always did, and I woke up in bed with a creep the following morning. And that's what drinking did to me. It changed my perception of reality. You know, creeps obviously became sexy at some point during the night. And that day I was desperate again, but I called Alcoholics Anonymous because my dad had gotten sober and I knew it worked. And the number was there in my secretary's office drawer. It was there waiting for me to call it. So somewhere or other, I'd been preparing for this unconsciously. And I called AA and I came in and I was desperate. I wanted the drunkenness out of my life. I wanted the deceit. I'd had an affair with one of my friend's husbands. I was sick, sick of myself, sick of the drink, sick of the smell of it. Sick of what I was doing. You know, I'd lost myself totally, and I wanted out of my life. So step one for me was easy in a way. My life was in a mess. I couldn't handle the drink. I understood that, but I didn't understand the bit about I can't stay away from it on my own. I thought the problem started when I drank, and they didn't. The problems were before I drank. It was the crazy head that would tell me, if you have a drink, it'll get better. That was the big lie that I was believing. And I had to come to understand that that was a lie, and it didn't work for me, it only hurted me. And that took me about 7 months of hanging around bars and just maybe feeling sorry for myself. I don't know, but I hung around the bars. I would go to AA, hang around bars drinking Coca-Cola or orange juice until I came to understand the lie. I no longer believed it, that a drink will not make it better. A drink will only make it worse. And I came to believe what the people were saying in Alcoholics Anonymous. They were my higher power until some of them got drunk, until some of them committed suicide. Can't be them. It must be stronger than these people. It must be this program, these 12 steps. And eventually it became even more than that, because when I would sit in an AA meeting, I would feel this grace that Thaddeus was talking about. Some people, maybe in the religious world, might call it the Holy Spirit. I would feel a power and a presence, and I've continued to feel it in AA meetings, even at this convention. Just, I'd be sitting in an AA meeting, feeling like I belong, that everything is okay. Not that it will be okay, it is okay. And that's grace. That's grace, to be given that space where I don't have to suffer. So I moved through the steps. I came to believe, and I made that decision that we talked about yesterday, and I turned my life over to the care of God. And then I went into, I think, the most exciting part of the steps, which is the inventory. Getting honest, really honest. Okay, I got honest about my drinking, but let's get honest about my life. and my will. You know, who the hell am I? Who the hell am I? Am I really this pathetic, lost human being that's full of self-pity and guilt and shame? Or is there something else more to me? And because I have the faith of step three, I know I can face this. I'll be okay with step three with me, holding my hand. And I discovered with step four, I discovered the reasons, I discovered why, what drove me, and it wasn't them that drove me. I'd always felt that I got myself into so much trouble because people weren't there for me. That was my big thing. You're not strong enough, why weren't you there for me? Why didn't you take care of me? Why did you let this happen to me? That was like the story of my life. And I was able with step four to say, I wasn't there for me. I didn't understand me. I didn't love me. It wasn't them. It was me. And as somebody else says, but only 100%. But only 100%. It's not even a little bit to do with my poor old mother. You know, I had a resentment against my mother. It wasn't her fault. She did nothing wrong. I thought I had to forgive her. I went through the whole forgiveness ritual only to discover there was nothing to forgive. The woman did nothing wrong. I'm the one that didn't believe in myself. I'm the one that believed I was useless and pathetic and lost. I had no faith in myself. By the time I got to step four, I was 4.5 years sober, and step five, I had started to change, and I could see that I was beginning to be a different person. You know, I wasn't loving and kind and all of that, but I was different. And I wasn't as self-centered as I was before. I wasn't as angry. And I started to see this other side to me starting to emerge. And as I moved forward with the next step, six and seven, which took years, it wasn't a question of minutes, it took years to understand that I wasn't going to change me, but that God would change me. And God for me is so big, it can't be described. It's bigger than life itself. And that life itself was going to change me, that I had to stop fighting it and resisting it and thinking I had to do it my way. And that's what I've been, is open to change, open to growth, and letting things come and letting them go and not being afraid that I need to control or it will go back to the way it was. My life today, it's like a little dance. It's like a dance, the 10, 11, and 12. This is how I live my life today, because all the principles from 1 to 9, for me, are all there in 10, 11, and 12. Being honest, which for me is critical. Being honest, prayer and meditation and service. That's how I need to live my life today. And to be open, and to have more of a don't know mind. I don't know who God is. Yes, I needed a concept to start with, but that's evolving and that's changing all the time. It's expanding, it's deepening. And I don't need to know who God is. What I need to do is to try and discover him on a day-by-day basis, to try and feel his presence. Where is the evidence in my life today that there is a God? Where is it? That's a question I ask myself every day. Where is the evidence that God is in my life today? And often I can't get past the first thought, which is, I'm alive. You know, it's gift. And before, when I would wake up in the morning as an active alcoholic and I discovered I was alive, it was like the worst thing happened to me. I always wanted to wake up either dead or old, that it was all over and all done. I was so scared of life. Today I wake up and I'm alive, and that in itself is gift. I've been given the chance to do life in a totally different way. I was given the chance to be a mother again, and this time to stay, to be in relationship with my husband, and to stay. And I'm an incredibly wonderful mother. I mean, I am naturally loving. I am naturally kind. I am naturally warm. I thought I was a cold bitch, and that was me. I thought that the active me was the natural me. And I discovered in sobriety, by just going through the steps, letting them go through me, I am naturally kind, I am naturally loving, I am a naturally a wonderful mother, and I intuitively know how to be a mother, and I intuitively know how to be a grandmother. It's incredible. I mean, where does this come from? And I really believe it is because, as I said yesterday, my concept of God governs my life. I still believe today I'm a child of God, whoever that is, and I have become the child of God. And that becoming is changing and evolving and deepening with each day. And it might sound like a lot of crap, but it's an incredible life that I have today. And I'm grateful for that. And I'll just finish with, people have talked about service and sponsorship and all of that. I didn't start sponsoring anybody till I was 11 years sober. Because I was the same personality for many, many years. I was changing bit by bit by bit, but it took time for that transformation to take place, for me to be interested in people, because as I said, I wasn't interested in people. I didn't like people. People let me down. I felt threatened by people. The world was an unfriendly place, so why would I let you get close to me? And that was changing and changing with the steps and the years in the program. And with about 11 years of sobriety, then I started to sponsor people. And that's also where I feel God's presence. When I'm sitting with a fellow alcoholic and we're sharing about our lives in sobriety and our understanding of God and the steps. And that's where I get my sweet spot. With my grandchild, with my daughter, with my sponsees, with my husband, it's like, all is gift and all is God. And I'm not talking about, you know, a religious entity, but all is gift and all is God. And when I believe that, the feelings I get are, the world is friendly, the world is kind, I don't feel threatened, I don't need walls, I don't need boundaries, I can be honest with you. And that's a great place to be. So, as they say in Sweden, tack så mycket for listening to me, and I open up the meeting for sharing.